The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today, we're reading from the August 16th, 2024 issue of the Week. Our cover drawing this week is a farm scene. Donald Trump is in the middle of a muddy pig pen. He's standing thigh deep in a mud puddle in his usual blue suit. But he's got mud all over him. He's looks like he's talking loudly at somebody looking at the viewer. He's got his hand raised and a handful of mud in it. There's a single startled-looking pig standing at the edge of the puddle looking on. The headline is Muck Thrower, Why Trump is Attacking Harris' Racial Identity. That's our controversy of the week. We'll start with the first main story. Harris reaches for Midwest with Waltz as Veep pick. What happened? Vice President Kamala Harris introduced Minnesota Governor Tim Walz as her running mate at a jubilant rally in Philadelphia this week, rocketing into the national spotlight a little-known former school teacher with rural roots, military pedigree, and a record of backing progressive legislation. The 60-year-old governor, who previously spent six terms as a congressman representing a largely rural Minnesota district, had been viewed as a dark horse candidate as speculation focused on two popular officials from key swing states, Arizona Senator Mark Kelly and Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro. But Harris reportedly clicked with the Midwesterner, a 24-year National Guard veteran who taught high school social studies and coached football before entering politics in 2006. "We both believe in lifting people up, not knocking them down," said Harris in Philadelphia. Waltz thanked her for bringing the joy back and said she's showing us the politics of what's possible. Waltz, whose branding of Donald Trump as weird caught fire among Democrats, doubled down saying Trump and running mate Senator J.D. Vance are creepy and, yes, weird as hell. He said Trump drove the economy into the ground as president and that violent crime went up on his watch. And that's not even counting the crimes he committed. Trump and Republicans attacked Waltz as a left-wing extremist, highlighting laws he backed as governor to restrict gun access, protect transgender therapies for children, and expand state services to undocumented immigrants. "Harris and Waltz are the most radical far-left ticket in the history of our country," said Republican National Committee Chair Michael Whatley. Vance said Harris passed over Shapiro, who is Jewish, out of anti-Semitism. Harris' husband is Jewish, while Trump called her low IQ and said a Harris presidency would bring crime, chaos, and death all across our country. Harris secured enough delegates to clinch the Democratic nomination and announced a fundraising windfall of $310 million for July. Trump raised nearly $139 million. An NPR PBS News Marist poll found that the Democrat now has a 3 percentage point edge over Trump nationally, 51% to 48%, while a Morning Consult poll had her up 48% to 44%, the largest lead over Trump for Harris or President Biden in nearly a year. What the editorial said: Harris picked Mayberry over Mayhem, said the Houston Chronicle. Shapiro and Kelly are centrists who might have helped her win a swing state, but she seems to have bypassed cold strategy in tapping the Nebraska-born Waltz, who looks like he could don a fake beard and have a second career as a Santa at a mall. He offers an antidote to MAGA rage and division, and his small-town relatability could prove critical in closely fought battleground states in the Midwest, especially Wisconsin and Michigan. With her misguided pick, Harris made her priorities clear, said the Wall Street Journal. She wants to rally her base rather than expand her reach. The logical choice was Shapiro, the popular center-left governor of a crucial swing state. But his support for Israel and school vouchers made him the target of a nasty campaign by leftists, and Harris appears to have wilted. Progressive will love Waltz's record of raising taxes and passing one of the nation's most permissive abortion statutes, but it won't play nearly as well with centrist voters. What the columnist said. In the end, it came down to vibes, said Eugene Daniels in Politico. Harris admired Waltz's progressive governing record, his biography, and his record of 6 wins in a red-leaning congressional district. But insiders say the key factor is that the two connected when Waltz sat for a one-on-one interview. Unlike the down-to-earth Waltz, Shapiro is an aspiring president whose style was seen by some Harris aides as showboating, and the spark just wasn't there. Don't underestimate what vibes can achieve, said David Rothkopf in the Daily Beast. As the Philly Love Fest showed, Harris and Waltz have galvanized voters with exuberance, joy, and a positive vision for the future, as Barack Obama, Ronald Reagan, and John F. Kennedy did in previous eras. Meanwhile, Trump offers nothing but rage and spite. And elections are about how candidates make you feel and not your reasoned reaction to their policies. All the smiles on earth can't disguise the fact that Americans are being confronted with the most left-wing presidential ticket in decades, said Noah Rothman in National Review. Amid the euphoria that followed Biden's defenestration, Harris has gotten a pass on her previous embrace of hard-left policies like fracking ban and open borders, and on her abrupt pivot away from them. But now she's yoked herself to a running mate who gave illegal immigrants driver's licenses and issued an executive order granting minors access to irreversible chemical and surgical treatments for gender dysphoria. Harris and Waltz should be beatable, said Jim Garrity in the Washington Post, but Trump can't stop shooting himself in the foot. At an Atlanta rally last week, he tore into Georgia's Republican Governor Brian Kemp, who resisted his efforts to overturn state election results in 2020, calling the popular head of a must-win state a bad guy and very disloyal person. A November win is still within reach if Trump would stop obsessing over his own sense of grievance and address things voters actually care about. But the more someone tells Trump not to stick a fork in an electric socket, the more Trump lunges to jab it in there, just to prove he can. And the controversy of the week, Trump, will his attacks on Harris' racial identity backfire? Well, that did not go well, said Noah Rothman in National Review. During a contentious back and forth last week with members of the National Association of Black Journalists, GOP presidential nominee Donald Trump was asked if he agrees with Republican charges that his Democratic rival, Vice President Kamala Harris, is an unqualified DEI hire. Rather than answering directly, Trump pivoted to questioning Harris' racial identity, accusing Harris, born in California to a Jamaican father and an Indian mother, of embracing her black heritage only for political gain. She was always of Indian heritage, Trump said. I didn't know she was black until a number of years ago when she happened to turn black. As the crowd jeered, Trump continued, is she Indian or is she black? I respect either one, but she obviously doesn't. Trump is factually wrong, said Corey Walker in Washington Examiner. Harris has long embraced both her South Asian and black heritage. She attended Howard, a historically black university. Regardless, Trump is being politically foolish. He should focus voters' attention on Harris' far-left electorally toxic policies, not the non-issue of whether she's actually black. Worse, his racially charged rhetoric risks reversing the surge in support he's received from black voters, while further alienating moderate voters. If Trump keeps this up, he's going to lose. Trump doesn't think so, said Amanda Marcotte in Salon. As elected Republicans were scurrying away from his racist attacks, the candidate himself doubled down. At a Pennsylvania rally later that day, screens flashed old news articles highlighting Harris' Indian American background. His running mate, J.D. Vance, who is married to an Indian American and has three biracial children, praised Trump's remarks as hysterical, insisting his boss was merely spotlighting Harris' fundamental chameleon-like nature. As with the birther claims against President Barack Obama that launched Trump's late-life political career, his feigned bewilderment at Harris' biracial identity is a calculated ploy, a way of provoking white anxieties about how multiracial societies are too confusing to be tolerated. This second iteration of birtherism has an even nastier edge, said Adam Serwer in The Atlantic. The smear against Harris is that she assumed different racial identities in different settings for professional advantage, an advantage denied to white Americans. So as well as othering Harris as strange and foreign, Trump is also making her a symbol of what MAGA types believe is the liberal conspiracy to deprive white people of what is rightfully theirs. Trump's toxic message could also bear fruit in the black community, said Nia Malika Henderson in Bloomberg. There are long-standing tensions between native-born black Americans and those with immigrant roots like Harris. Questioning her blackness could resonate with enough black voters to make a difference in a close election. Harris mustn't take Trump's bait, said Matt Bai in the Washington Post. She has tried to take the high road, briefly chiding Trump for his divisiveness and disrespect. But even such understated responses risk playing into the stereotype Trump is trying to fit her into, the angry black woman who sees racism around every corner. Harris and the rest of us need to brace for the possibility that this race could get incredibly nasty, said William Crystal in The Bulwark. If Harris' surge in the polls, effectively tying the presidential race, prompted Trump to launch these vile attacks, what will he be saying in a few weeks if he's actually fallen behind? Time for our Good Week, Bad Week piece. It's a good week for Canine Chic. After Italian fashion house Dolce & Gabbana debuted Fefe, a designer fragrance just for dogs. An olfactory masterpiece with hints of musk, sandalwood, and lang lang, according to D&G. A 3.4-ounce bottle of Fefe retails for $109. It was a good week for excellence. After the announcement that Keanu Reeves and Alex Winter, who played the titular roles in the 1989 movie Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, will reunite on Broadway in Waiting for Godot, Samuel Beckett's 1953 exploration of existence and futility. It's a good week for grave robbers. After reports that Scottish medical schools are running out of cadavers due to a surge in the number of medical students, in 19th century Scotland, such shortages inspired a spate of grave robbings and at least one for-profit murder spree. But it was a bad week for manhood after French pole vaulter Anthony Ammirati failed his Olympics qualifying heat when the bulge of his crotch appeared to dislodge the bar during an otherwise successful vault. It was a big disappointment, said Ammirati, 21. It's a bad week for steerage after Korean Air said it will no longer serve cups of instant noodles in economy class because of an increasing turbulence. Those in business and first class will still get ramen, the airline said, but the risk of burns is greater with passengers crowded together. Finally, it was a bad week for wishful thinking after Donald Trump predicted in a social media post that crooked Joe Biden will crash this month's Democratic National Convention and try to take back the nomination that was unconstitutionally stolen from him by Kamala Harris. The title of the briefing this week is America's Home Insurance Crisis. Climate change is making storms and wildfires more intense, leading insurers to hike rates and drop out of risky markets. How fast are rates rising? The cost of insuring the average U.S. home has spiked nearly 38% since 2019. To $2,478 annually, according to a report by the broker LendingTree. That's the national picture, but the rises are steeper in areas hit hardest by climate and weather-related disasters. In hurricane-prone Florida, premiums climbed 42.5% over that period. In Arizona, 62.1%. One California resident who lives in the wildfire-scorched hills north of Sacramento saw her premium leap fivefold this year, from $3,531 to $19,310. The struggle to find affordable coverage is being made even harder by the exit of many providers from high-risk areas. Allstate paused sales of new homeowners' policies in California in 2022, citing, in part, more frequent and severe weather. And State Farm did the same last year. Similar pullouts are taking place in Florida, where the taxpayer-backed Citizens Property Insurance is now the state's largest insurer, as well as Illinois, Indiana, and Ohio. Those Midwestern states were once seen as havens from climate shocks, but are now suffering more frequent and intense storms. I believe we're marching toward an uninsurable future in many places, said Dave Jones, head of the Climate Risk Initiative at the University of California, Berkeley's Law School. Why are insurers taking these steps? Because they've been losing money for a decade. Home insurers paid out more in claims than they received in premiums in 18 states last year, up from 12 states in 2018. And 8 states in 2013, a New York Times analysis found. Last year was the most painful for the industry since 2011, with home insurers losing more than $101 billion. Faced with worsening climate and weather disasters, the reinsurance policies that insurance firms buy to make sure they can cover such events have become more expensive. The Texas Windstorm Insurance Association, a high-risk insurer along the Gulf Coast, paid $206 million for reinsurance last year, a 63% jump from 2022. To cover these costs, insurers either have to hike rates or become much more selective about where they do business. Climate change is real, said Bill Montgomery, CEO of Selena Insurance Group, which exited Iowa in 2022, after paying out $1.5 million more in losses than it took in premiums. We can't raise rates fast enough or high enough. Are other factors pushing up prices? The spike in premiums is also partly a result of properties getting more expensive, because as home prices climb, they're up nationally about 28% since 2019, so does the cost to insure them. Then there's the effect of COVID-era inflation and supply chain disruptions, which helped drive up home rebuilding and replacement cost by 55% from 2020 to 2022, according to the Insurance Information Institute, resulting in bigger insurance payouts. The home insurance sector has weathered tough periods before, including sustained losses from 2008 to 2012. But experts say climate change has upended the industry's core financial model. That model was designed to balance good and bad years, but the bad now outnumber the good. Last year, the U.S. endured a record 28 climate and weather disasters that each caused at least $1 billion in damage. 2020 held the previous record at 22. In the 1980s, there were 33 such billion-dollar disasters over the entire decade. What are the consequences of this turmoil? For many homeowners, the result is economic hardship. Diana Troxell, 76, discovered last year that her insurer was not renewing the $1,910 policy on her manufactured home in rural Cottonwood, California, because of wildfire exposure. She and her husband now pay $6,660 annually through California's FAIR Plan, an insurer of last resort. "We're in, how are we going to do this mode," Troxell said. "We're living month to month." Some Americans who own their properties outright are bailing on insurance entirely. 12% of homeowners were uninsured in 2022, up from 5% in 2019, while others are buying bare-bones plans that don't cover natural disasters. But going uninsured or underinsured carries immense risk. It's very unrealistic for any homeowner to think they can pay for catastrophic losses out of pocket, said Mark Friedlander of the Insurance Information Institute. Can the insurance sector be stabilized? The power to regulate insurers lies with states, which set maximum rate increases, the extent of coverage, and consumer protections. Some states, like Louisiana and Washington, are trying to make it easier for insurers to turn a profit in hopes they won't exit the market by accelerating the process by which they can raise premiums. Arkansas, meanwhile, recently let insurers increase the deductibles of people whose homes have been damaged by hail or storms. California, Minnesota, Georgia, and other states are trying to reduce potential losses by encouraging homeowners to make their properties more resilient, such as by installing fire or storm-resistant roofs, and then requiring insurers to offer discounts to customers to take those steps. But some experts argue that in a warming world with more dangerous weather, part of the solution will have to involve reducing or even stopping development in areas that are most vulnerable to storms, wildfires, and rising seas. There could be parts of states that are just not suitable for insurance, said George Hosfield of LexisNexis Risk Solutions, because really, they're not suitable for home building. Time for the best columns of the week. I think I'll actually read all three from the U.S. this week. Did Egypt give Trump a big bribe? It's the most serious presidential bribery allegation in American history, said Will Bunch, yet it barely made a stir. 5 days before Donald Trump took office in 2017, the Washington Post revealed last week the state-run National Bank of Egypt got a request from a government source to kindly withdraw almost $10 million in U.S. currency. Federal investigators found out about this suspicious withdrawal in 2019 and began examining whether Egyptian dictator Abdel Fattah el-Sisi illegally gave Trump the cash. As it happens, Trump put $10 million of his own money into his campaign shortly before the Egyptian withdrawal. All that was missing was the smoking gun that could tie in, all that was missing was the smoking gun that could lie in Trump's unexamined bank records. But then Attorney General William Barr blocked the investigation. As president, Trump released $1.4 billion in military aid to Egypt and called el-Sisi my favorite dictator. It was Egypt, of course, that bribed the recently convicted Senator Robert Menendez with gold bars and cash. Amid widespread cynicism, far too much blatant corruption is met with a giant shrug. Congress should open a full-blown investigation into why Barr shut down the original probe. Let's make bribery a crime again. The reason birth rates keep falling. The steep decline in the U.S. birth rate may be beyond the scope of any government-based solution, said Christine Imba. A recent poll found that a startling 47% of all adults under 50 say they are unlikely to ever have children. The current U.S. fertility rate of 1.6 children per woman is well below the replacement rate of 2.1 children. This steep decline has renewed calls by policymakers and pundits for expensive government interventions to make it easier and less expensive to raise children. But economics is not the real issue. Attempts by many European and Asian countries to raise fertility rates with generous family policies have failed. The deeper problem is that in an era of declining religiosity and rising individualism, many young adults aren't certain that producing more human beings is an unqualified good. Lacking a clear sense of meaning, they fear that having children may make the world worse. Why bring children into a future marred by climate change, pandemics, war, and global chaos? The belief that having children is worth all the personal sacrifice involved is not something governments can easily provide. It will have to come from another source. Are mass deportations possible? Donald Trump is vowing to carry out the largest deportation operations in American history, said Ed Kilgore. At the Republican National Convention in July, beaming delegates waved mass deportation now signs. But hunting down more than 10 million undocumented immigrants, locking them up in vast detention camps, and flying or trucking them back to their countries of origin would be wildly unpopular, impractical, and economically ruinous. A recent Pew survey found only 37% of Americans support such radical plans, which would necessarily require a vast national scheme of surveillance, racial and ethnic profiling, and daily scenes of violence and misery. In 2023, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, spent $420 million to deport 142,580 people. Deporting millions of people would easily cost tens of billions. There would be additional astronomical costs for detaining immigrants for weeks and months, and a spectacular increase in the burden on already clogged immigration courts. Meanwhile, the loss of millions of migrant workers in farming, construction, and other industries would raise prices, ramp up inflation, and likely trigger a recession. If Trump's un-American plan comes to fruition, it will wreak havoc on our nation, and Republicans will come to regret it. Time for the last word, our feature article. The $150,000 alpha dog. The Svalin dog is the new status symbol for the well-heeled, said Ben Ryder Howe in New York Magazine. A military-grade beast that can rip out an attacker's throat, but is also a loving, gentle pet. A few years ago in Bozeman, Montana, a brain surgeon and his wife were walking through a farmer's market when they came across a booth selling dogs. The breeder, called Zvalin, touted them as a one-of-a-kind hybrid. Military-grade protection dogs with elite danger-sensing instincts, but the warmth and temperament of a conventional family pet. The surgeon, Regis Haig, took a closer look at the dogs, which did indeed seem magnificent, intelligent, and powerful. Then he saw the cost, at least $150,000 each. Haig's wife, Mary Ellen, was interested. He told her, "There's no way I'm going to spend that kind of money. Are you out of your mind?" Many stories about Zvalin dogs begin this way. The Haigs couldn't stop thinking about the animals they'd seen, and before long, they drove to Zvalin's training facility. Each dog is an undisclosed mix of Dutch Shepherd, German Shepherd, and Belgian Malinois. "They put the dogs through all these obstacle courses and things," Haig recalled. "I was in the military. I had an Air Force scholarship to med school, and I've hunted. These dogs, they're like humans." Many high-dollar protection dogs are nothing but menace. Haig approached one of the Zvalin dogs, who nuzzled his hand. He and Mary Ellen now own two. Zvalin says that it sells no more than 20 dogs a year, and only about 350 exist around the world. One of the owners, Stephen Mazzola, an airline pilot, read about Zvalin in Mountain Outlaw magazine shortly before moving to the Bitterroot Valley near the Idaho-Montana border and scheduled a visit to the breeder. He and his wife, Chris, a retired nurse anesthetist, fell in love with one of the biggest males available, a door kicker they named Jet. Mazzola, who used to fly F-16s, was stunned by Jet's abilities. "I feel like we have a gentle Navy SEAL in the house," he says. "I find myself giving a command and going, 'Holy cow, that really works.'" He describes standing at a restaurant counter with Jet hovering at his side, looking the other direction where all the people are. "That's the automatic thing with them. The training kind of morphs into the instinct to protect the family." He pauses. It turns into a very emotional thing. Zvalin's founder, Kim Green, did not set out to create a luxury object. In the aughts, she was living in Nairobi with her then-husband, Jeff, a former Green Beret whose business provided private security to diplomats and NGOs. Nairobi had a carjacking problem, and after Kim gave birth to twins, Jeff asked her to carry a gun. Kim declined, feeling that if she were attacked, she would be unlikely to use it. Instead, she got a pair of Dutch Shepherds named Banshee and Briggs. "The dogs were hot," said Green, "ready to jump through a car window and maul an attacker at the slightest provocation. They were weapons, not pets, and kind of pains in the ass." In Nairobi, the Greens had a sideline breeding Rhodesian Ridgebacks for the expat community, and they also sold dogs to the U.S. They noticed that people became more interested in tactical canines after the raid that killed Osama bin Laden, which featured a Belgian Malinois named Cairo. The Greens moved back to the U.S. in 2013, intent on creating a market for beasts that could rip out an attacker's trachea, yet also function as pets. They established Zvalin, which in Nordic mythology refers to a shield protecting the world. At a former equestrian training facility outside Livingston in Montana's Paradise Valley. The couple has since divorced, and Kim Green now runs the business. Approaching the site recently amid panoramic views of snow-capped mountains, I see signs warning of danger ahead, then arrive at a converted indoor riding arena at the end of a winding dirt road. Somewhere inside, dogs are barking. This part of Montana is one of the remotest areas of the country, and in Zvalin's early years, many would-be buyers either resisted making the trip or tried to have someone do it for them. So many people are used to having their staff do things, said Green. Today that happens less often, in part because Montana is now where many of her clients live, at least some of the time. Over the past decade, the state has seen an enormous influx of extreme wealth. Clients, Green says, sometimes ask her if dogs are suited for frequent travel by private jet or helicopter. People say, I have a big motorboat. I need to have my dog climb out of the water on a ladder. She makes an expression as if to say, of course her dogs can do these things. Green has a way of talking about dogs that reflects her background as a military contractor. But sometimes she refers to them as assets. But just as often, she's a little woo-woo, whether talking about energy transference between dogs and humans or a mystical, all-important canine quality she calls stability. The concept seems to combine firmness of nerves, supreme control, and physical balance. Stability is bred at the Phoenix, an obstacle course at the Zvalin Ranch resembling a jungle gym. The Phoenix looks easy, but its components, swinging tires the dogs have to leap through, balance beams narrower than their paws, are designed to make them pant. Increased athleticism is one result, but the Phoenix is also meant to be a thinking exercise. Its components are reconfigured every day so that the dogs can't complete it on autopilot. The training takes 2 or 3 years, and the hoped for result is a dog that comes through the door with its shoulders thrust forward, unafraid of new situations, yet attuned to its environment. Green contrasts this with a typical American pet, an adoring family oaf. We don't expect them to do anything other than wag their tail and be goofy and cute. Pets have long been symbols of wealth and power, from Chopette Lagerfeld to J. Paul Getty's lion, Teresa. Lately, however, pets have also become symbols of politics. Last December, an editor at the New York Times, Alicia P.Q. Whitmire, wrote at length about the online world of dog training. Whitmire found two camps: those who believe in aversive training methods, such as shock collars, and those who reject such methods or any attempt to discipline at all. The battle lines mirror the culture wars with unsettling precision, Whitmire found. Anti-aversives are prone to linking their beliefs about dogs to larger battles against the patriarchy or colonialisms, while their opponents see themselves as standing up to woke idiots. Green is an aversive. She is both a disciplinarian and a believer in replicating the harsh conditions of the wild. She wants to civilize dogs, to give them manners, at the same time that she hopes to bring out their inner savages. Not all animals in her care survive this process. If nature takes puppies, she says, it takes puppies. She means that if newborns are abandoned by their mother and seem likely to die, perhaps of exposure, she and her staff refuse to intervene. She aims to keep everything as close to nature as possible. That means choke collars, no toys or treats, and a diet of beef or raw elk meat served on the bone. Dogs grow up in the pit, a dirt-floored barn with an odor so intense, I feel the urge to run outside. For an owner looking to show off their Zvalin dog on St. Bart's or at the Yellowstone Club, amid designer breeds that cost a mere $10,000, this is surely part of the appeal. Dogs have been bred to be middle class, safe, dumb, and boring. Zvalin gives them their teeth back. After buyers purchase and bring home their dog, a Zvalin handler visits within 45 days to see if they have kept up with the dog's training or introduced bad habits. Luxury objects like an out-of-tune Steinway need extra love and care. Green positions her company as a full concierge service. You're becoming part of the club, she says. You're buying into support and troubleshooting and backstopping. We're on the phone anytime you need us. It's like all of a sudden you've got a trip to Australia. We can be at your doorstep to collect your animal and re-deliver in 2 weeks later. Being admitted to the club means buying into Svalin's philosophy of the dog as a functional organism, born to perform tasks. Dogs are like humans, Green says. They get pretty spun out when they don't know what the rules are. They thrive on structure. Not surprisingly, Green subscribes to pack theory, the belief that dogs, like wolves, are born innately willing to be led by a dominant leader. Critics say pack theory can be used to justify an aggressive bullying approach. I don't love the word dominance myself, said Green. Nevertheless, she adds, this isn't a democracy. There is a hierarchy. Her business card reads, Alpha Female. Green and I are standing next to the Phoenix, watching a big dog named Nile go through the paces. According to his handler, Matt, Nile is a no BS dog, as shown by wounds up and down Matt's arms. Protection work is a major component of Svalin's trainings, which handlers bear the brunt of. Also training on the Phoenix are Pappy, an old soul balancing with all four paws on a 2.5-inch wooden plank, and Pua, a younger dog whom Green calls a little ballistic fur missile. In general, Green prefers smaller, more discreet animals. Her dogs are typically listed at 60 pounds. Some of our would-be competitors breeds 120-pound German Shepherds, she said. That might be a deterrent, but it's not going in the car with you. And it sheds everywhere. And it drools. After a few minutes of commando-type activity, the dogs are summoned to a row of podiums, which they mount one by one. This has the awkwardness of a beauty pageant, but it is impossible not to be impressed by the disciplined, alert calmness of Pappy, Nile, and Pua. Not only is there no drooling, the dogs seem locked in on the salient thing in the room, the single aspect of their environment that has changed, the outsider that their human handlers are focused on, me. Green demonstrates a deployment with Pappy, who is riled up to attack a young trainer named Cullen. Protect your family, a trainer shouts. Pappy launches at Cullen, who, as he fights off the frenzied dog, seems to be in considerable pain, despite the protection of a bite suit. When the drill is called off, Pappy disengages immediately. I ask Green if I can experience an attack. For the first time, she seems unsure. If you promise not to sue us, she says. For a protection training to be effective, a dog has to believe that the threat is real. Svalin dogs are trained to disarm, maim, and potentially kill, but they cannot be headhunters. They have to be discerning killers, and they have to be able to be overridden, which is why we built in an off switch, says Green. The safe words are out and phooey it. The trainers bring out Whistler, a young, if not visibly smaller dog. To protect me from having my femoral artery ripped out, I get the bite suit, which covers much of my body and is made out of what seems to be a cheap rug. Shuffling under its not terribly reassuring thickness, I hide around a corner, per instructions. Then one of my female trainers starts to shriek. From my hiding spot, I inch around and make eye contact with Whistler. Matt has him on a leash, barely. Act menacing, Matt says. Rawr. More, like you mean it. Rawr. Suddenly, Whistler is attached to my triceps, snarling, drooling, writhing, jerking my arm back and forth as she pushes me against the wall. There's no pain. The bite suit dulls most of the pressure. But after 30 seconds, I've had enough and signal as much to the handlers, who hit the off switch. Nothing happens. Out, Matt commands. Phooey it. I look in Whistler's adrenaline-blurred eyes. Inches from my own, I see nothing. Out. Whistler, out. Eventually, Matt puts the dog in a headlock to get her to release. Green sighs. Later, she says, this is why we train them. For 2.5 years. I should have spelled that name from the beginning. Zvalin is spelled S-V-A-L-I-N-N. And this was adapted from an article that first appeared in New York Magazine. We'll read a couple of the health and science pieces this week. Hints of ancient microbial life on Mars. Was there once life on Mars? A spotty rock that was just discovered on the Red Planet contains features that suggest microbial life may have flourished there billions of years ago, reports SmithsonianMag.com. The 3 foot by 2 foot rocked rock called Chiava Falls was found in an ancient river delta last month by NASA's Perseverance rover. In it, the rover's instruments detected signs of organic compounds, one of the building blocks for life. Perseverance also registered veins of calcium sulfate, which suggests that water, another crucial ingredient for life, once flowed through the rock. And it found tiny leopard-like surface spots containing iron and phosphate, possible signs of chemical reactions that could have provided the energy for life. Any one of these features might have been caused by non-biological processes, but all of them together are a good indication that life may well have emerged on Mars back when it had a dense atmosphere and flowing water. To learn more, scientists will have to wait until Chiava Falls can be ferried back to Earth, which isn't scheduled to happen before 2040. We have zapped that rock with lasers and X-rays and imaged it literally day and night from just about every angle imaginable, said Ken Farley, a geochemist at the California Institute of Technology, working on the NASA mission. Scientifically, Perseverance has nothing more to give. Blood test for Alzheimer's. In a major breakthrough for diagnosing Alzheimer's, a simple blood test has proved significantly more accurate at identifying the condition than cognitive tests and CT scans. The blood test, which measures levels of tau, a protein involved in the development of the disease, correctly showed whether patients with memory problems had the neurological condition about 90% of the time, reports the New York Times. That compares with a success rate of 73% for dementia specialists and only 61% for primary care doctors. The study was conducted in Sweden, where the population isn't very diverse, so the results may not hold for all demographics. And the test is useful only for those already experiencing memory problems, not to predict whether someone may develop the condition. Still, for those cases, a blood test will be much faster and cheaper than other methods of diagnosis. Not too long ago, measuring pathology in the brain of a living human was considered just impossible, says Jason Karlowish from the University of Pennsylvania, who was not involved in the research. This study adds to the revolution that has occurred in our ability to measure what's going on in the brain. And on the Talking Points page, we'll start with the article, Prisoner Swap, Rewarding Hostage Taking. President Biden should take a victory lap after negotiating the largest prisoner swap with Russia since the Cold War, said Alex Wagner in MSNBC.com. In exchange for 8 Russian spies and criminals held by the U.S. and allied nations, Moscow last week released 16 prisoners, including Americans and prominent Russian dissidents. Among those freed were Wall Street Journal reporter Evan Gershkovich, imprisoned for more than a year on a bogus espionage charge, and Marine veteran Paul Whelan, detained since 2018 as a spy. The trade was the result of a year of complicated talks involving seven nations in which Biden played a central role. On July 21st, while recovering from COVID and preparing to announce his exit from the presidential race, he hammered out the final details with Slovenia's prime minister. Western negotiators deduced their Russian counterparts were keen to wrap up the deal before the U.S. election, said Bohan Pajevski in the Wall Street Journal. They suspected the Russians were worried about the return to power of an unpredictable Donald Trump, a fierce critic of Germany who might not have been able to persuade Berlin to release a top Russian hitman. That assassin was Vadim Krasilov, who straight up murdered a Russian dissident in broad daylight in a public park in Berlin, said Jim Garrity in National Review. He's a free man now, along with the likes of Vadim Konoshnikov, who smuggled U.S.-made electronics and ammunition to aid Moscow's war in Ukraine. We can and should rejoice at news of the release of wrongfully convicted foreigners used as pawns by the vile regime of Vladimir Putin. But this trade sends a message to every bad actor in Russia's orbit. If you get caught, don't talk. Sit tight. Putin can and will get you out eventually. The Kremlin knows its hostage-taking works, which means more kidnappings and wrongful arrests are inevitable. Let's not forget the Americans still unjustly incarcerated in Russia, said Brett Forrest and Louise Rudnovsky in the Wall Street Journal. Up to 20 U.S. citizens remain in Russian jails and labor camps. Those held include teachers, musicians, and dual citizens, such as Ksenia Karolina, an amateur ballerina arrested in January while visiting her Russian grandmother. Charged with treason, Karolina, 33, faces life in prison for donating $51 to a Ukrainian charity. This ongoing nightmare should be a warning to any Westerners who set foot in Russia, said Tom Nichols in The Atlantic. They, too, could become the next bargaining chips for some future deal. And some of the short notes. Of the 42 people who worked in Donald Trump's cabinet, 24 support his bid for a second term. They include former Attorney General William Barr, who said a year ago that Trump shouldn't be anywhere near the Oval Office, but now says he will vote for him. The legalization of marijuana likely accounts for an extra 1,400 traffic deaths in the U.S. each year, according to a study in the International Journal of Drug Policy. In states with consistent testing, a growing share of crashes involve drivers who test positive for the drug, including more than a third of such crashes in Connecticut and a quarter of those in New Jersey. Since April 2020, the population of children under 5 has fallen 18% in New York City, 15% in Illinois' Cook County, which includes Chicago, and 14% in Los Angeles County. The drops reflect both a family exodus during the pandemic and birth rates that have fallen in big cities at twice the rate of those in rural areas over the past decade. At least 379 people died worldwide while taking selfies from 2008 to 2021. More than four times the number from shark attacks, falls from buildings, bridges, and scenic overlooks and other high up locations accounted for about 50% of the deaths, followed by transport related incidents, 28%, and drownings, 13%. Tourists accounted for more than a third of the victims. On the poll watch, 54% of Americans say it is very important for the U.S. to take an active role in world affairs. 36% say it is somewhat important, and 7% say it is not too important. 72% of Americans blame the Secret Service for the assassination attempt on Donald Trump. 78% blame the country's political division. 59% say the media is responsible, and 58% point to the availability of guns. Running just a little ahead of schedule, so we'll actually read three quotes today. Molly Ivins, quoted in Esquire, says, "The thing is this. You got to have fun while you're fighting for freedom, because you don't always win." Brené Brown, quoted in Slate, says, "Anger is a powerful catalyst, but a life-sucking companion." And finally, Groucho Marx, quoted in Harper's, says, "I'm not crazy about reality, but it's still the only place to get a decent meal." With that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. We hope you have enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information, if you have questions or comments, please give us a call. That number is 919-832-5138. 919-832-5138. And as always, thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.